C.D. Wright was an American original, ever forging new paths into the poetic wilderness, never limiting herself to any particular form or style. Her 15 books of poetry, essays, and documentaries explore a wide range of geographies and people, with a promise of much more to come until her sudden death in January 2016 at age 67. With the posthumous publication of her poetry book, Shall Cross, in April 2016, New Letters on the Air pays tribute to this great poet and teacher with excerpts from two interviews, one in 1999 and another in 2009. Born Carolyn Diane Wright on January 6, 1949 in Mountain Home, Arkansas, where her father was a judge and her mother a court reporter, she considered law for a while but became an examiner of language instead, adopting the initials because another writer was named Carolyn Wright. Her many honors most recently include both the National Book Critics Circle Award and the Lenore Marshall Poetry Prize for her 2010 book-length documentary poem, One with Others, based on a 1969 Arkansas civil rights incident. In 2013, the former Rhode Island Poet Laureate, who taught at Brown University, became a chancellor to the Academy of American Poets. I'm Angela Elam, and I talked with C.D. Wright while she was the 2009 Cockafair Chair Writer in residence at the University of Missouri, Kansas City.
Some writers find their form or their signature MO very early on in their writing, and then after that, that tree is off the road. That issue of how am I going to present myself as a writer is no longer there, and they can pour everything they have to say through that form. And I was just always very restless about that. And also, I didn't develop a lot of formal skill until I had done quite a bit of writing and didn't become preoccupied with form. I think I was initially driven by storyline.
Yeah, because a lot of your early work has a narrative that runs through
it. It does. It's more narrative. Although I'm still interested in narrativity, I'm just not interested in it as taking the central position. So I moved a lot. You know, I was living in Northwest Arkansas for many years, and I lived in Memphis, and I lived in San Francisco, and I lived in Atlanta, and I lived in Central Mexico, and I lived in New York City, and then I ended up in Providence, Rhode Island. So those geographic shifts also meant I was familiarizing myself with a lot of different camps of poetry and tendencies in contemporary poetry, and also that I was moving from rural environments to cities, and that affected my own approaches to writing.
We'll hear more of this conversation with C.D. Wright later, but turn now to part of a 1999 interview when she was at Rockhurst University's Midwest Poets Series. Here's H.L. Hicks.
You say at one point that you resent the city that's not informed by the country. What is it about the country that poetry needs to listen to?
I mean, there are many strains of American poetry, but if there is a great divide, it's between urban and rural. And I like border crossing. I like the city, and I like the consciousness of the city. I like the stimuli of the city. But I don't see why I have to forego what I might learn and hear and feel and touch and understand and somehow make sense of from the country. So it sort of doesn't matter what my particular writing project is. It has always sort of adhered to that idea that I don't want one without the other, that I find a place for both in one or the other, that just because the locus is the South, that doesn't mean I can't bring something from my urban cousins to that project. Right. And if the project is the ruins of Providence, I don't see why I can't bring a little bit of Arkansas
right
into that.
Well, it is interesting that the term regional is often used pejoratively in criticism and in academia, and yet a body of work that's connected to a specific city is not labeled regional.
That's right.
But a body of work that's related to a
right.
rural area.
If it's
is.
Related to a specific city, it's considered cerebral.
Right.
If it's related to a specific landscape, it's considered pastoral. But I don't believe that.
Yeah.
I think those distinctions are really bromidal anyway, and they're not very useful. And it just occludes seeing what there is to see.
Well, surely some of that comes from background, having been born in rural Arkansas and teaching now at an Ivy League university. There's already that combination in your life. You've seen that range
yourself.
Yes,
sure. It's an outgrowth of my own mobility. When I left the Arkansas Ozarks and moved to San Francisco, I thought Fayetteville was the center of the universe and Dixon Street was the center of Fayetteville and Roger's Pool Hall was the center of Dixon Street and Roger was the Buddha, you know. And then when I got to San Francisco, poets were underfoot and they were on many different teams and I wasn't used to such fine distinctions being made. And I was sort of paralyzed by that initially because I just didn't know what to make of it. I was more of that Flannery O'Connor camp who divides people between the irksome and the non-irksome, you know, and maybe as far as the medium irksome and the rare irksome. So it was a real eye-opener for me. But then once I started being able to pick my way through that fray, there was a lot I thought I could use for my own fire.
Let's listen to some of that fire. Here's C.D. Wright reading an excerpt from her book-length poem, Deep Step Come Shining, for New Letters on the Air.
Healers in these parts can make one whole or deathly ill. If the swamp doctor pencils a series of random numbers on some bones, you could win cash or a convertible. If your given name is penciled on a string of ribs, whatever the swamp doctor says, comply. Whether a believer or not, remember, Pascal Schud, our very air has weight, it can be measured. In the ceaselessly decomposing smoke of a pool hall, seven green tables are racked under seven naked bulbs. The jukebox in the den calls the man a blankety blank blank, if not the exact words, the exact tenor. The plate glass casts glimpses of everything that has ever happened. The genesis of direction breaks and scatters.
That's a prose passage from the book-length poem Deep Step Come Shining, what the late C.D. Wright referred to as a road poem because it traveled through a geography, exploring a sort of wilderness between the city and the country, filled with recurring images. Her use of circulatory language and the naming of things also intrigued poet H.L. Hicks in this 1999 New Letters on the Air interview.
Do you envision your poems bringing nomenclature to the audience of poetry, or do you envision that nomenclature helping your poems to speak to others who might not otherwise be poetry readers?
The question of audience is a really hard question to answer. Who are you doing this for? Anyone who will listen. But are they my peers? You know, of course, you want your peers to love you. And are they strangers who just like to read? Well, you want that even more. Poetry readers are brought in one by one.
Yeah.
So people will sabotage your expectations about who can access this or who can't, you know, or who won't. Yeah. Zukofsky said it's stupid to say poetry is opposed to because it's added to, like science. That's the sort of community I would hope for.
Talk about the statement that you make that your poems are a novel compressed onto a single page.
I think before I thought in terms of creating a whole story in a short space, and that what you had to do to make that happen was just put a certain amount of pressure on the language and leave a lot out.
Right.
It doesn't seem so simple anymore, and my sense of narrative has changed. I still love to be told a story, but I like it to be told more obliquely.
Tell all the truth, but tell it slant.
Yeah. Right.
So that a poem like Deep Step Come Shining seems to me more like a wilderness in which the reader makes more of the narrative himself or herself
than is told.
Yeah.
I think you do have to activate the contemporary reader, that they have to have an active role in it in order to stay engaged in it. Otherwise, it becomes a kind of passive activity like watching television, I think, if you tell the whole thing and lay it all out and put everything in the right sequence. Probably film, more than anything else, has affected that we're so used to cuts and time shifts and everything without any explanation and without all that filler that we get bored, and it becomes a kind of anesthetizing process. So both for my position as a writer and as a reader, I like things to have more torque in them.
Right. Yeah, Wittgenstein said, anything your reader can do for himself, leave to him.
That's right.
Our being accustomed to cuts and so on from television and film, you're not only resisting that, but also taking advantage of it, drawing on that as a resource so that a reader coming to Deep Step Come Shining is able to follow the swift movements from idea and image to idea and image.
You assume the reader, you know, has similarly been deluged with moving images and knows how to make these kinds of leaps and interpretations on their own. Also, you know, once you learn how to do something, then it's time to learn something else. I want to learn something from this process, you know, more than I want to instruct. I want to see what else is out there. Can we hear it? Can we see it? Do we have the words for it? Can I find the words for it? Can I find a shape for it?
And the listing that manages to produce a kind of narrative, the list that might initially seem random, establishes a pattern and a connection, and your word from earlier, a torque.
I mean, our lives are narratives. You can't quite get rid of it. I mean, abstraction is great, but it leaves out a lot. But a narrative, you can torque it, you can suppress it, you can deform it, you can misshape it, and it's still there. We insist upon them. We create them ourselves. So it doesn't take much before it does formulate itself in our minds. So maybe the less you tell, the more variations there are on how it formulates itself in different minds. That seems like a pleasant outcome.
Yeah. Well, and so making a poem and making a life seem to you like directly related enterprises.
They do. It's both a struggle.
Right.
But, you know, Gertrude Stein thought it was a struggle, but a winnable one, you know. On my better days, I take the same attitude.
Would you read us a poem?
Sure. There's that poem, Flame, three columns of single words. The breath, the trees, the bridge, the road, the rain, the sheen. The breath, the line, the skin, the vineyard, the fences, the leg, the water, the breath, the shift, the hair, the wheels, the shoulder, the breath, the lane, the streak, the lining, the hour, the reasons, the name, the distance, the breath, the scent, the dogs, the blear, the lungs, the breath, the glove, the signal, the turn, the need, the steps, the lights, the door, the mouth, the tongue, the eyes, the burn, the burned, the burning.
C.D. Wright and the poem Flame from the collection Trimble, published in 1996 by Echo Press. She's talking here with poet H.L. Hicks.
Can you talk a little bit about Trimble? Very different type of book, different organization. What about that book?
I wanted to see if I could be a lyric poet in my lifetime. It's not that I abandoned in all sense of narrativity. I just wanted to move it into the background and not the foreground. And I wanted to work with a much more crystallized technique and much more pressure on the language. And it was really fun to write. I thought it was a really dark and sexy book.
I second that. So can you talk about the presence of the fingers throughout the book, as well as the mirror, some repeated themes, some connections poem to poem?
This one I wasn't working with a particular vocabulary so much. I think, though, that when I do write a collection of poems or an extended poem, that I'm very interested, very keen on a compositional whole. I guess I'm pretending to be a painter, you know. I want it to have this completeness. I want it to be suspended in its own space. And so I work out little ligatures. And, you know, I don't always know whether it's working or not, but I want it to have links with the other. I want the poems to resonate off of each other.
Right. You speak about language and voice. At another point, you say, I aim to carry the smoked ham of my voice to Beulah Land, which besides being a wonderful sentence, seems to me to be a preparation for this kind of poem. I hear a distinct dialect, even an accent. I hear a specific voice in the poems. How do you make that happen?
Well, it's a matter of never having lost that accent, partly, and so I can hear it, and partly never seeing any reason to lose it, thinking that it was serviceable
right.
in terms of poetry. Once you become conscious of something that you came by fairly naturally, then you have to figure out how to make it work as art, as artifice, and that's a different thing. Then you have to know when to take it out of the picture, you know, so that it's not all voice and no teeth or all teeth and no voice. I use it. I mean, I consider it a tool now.
The late C.D. Wright in 1999 with fellow poet H.L. Hicks. Wright carried her Arkansas roots with her to Rhode Island, where she taught at Brown University from 1983, the year she also married the poet Forrest Gander, until her death in January 2016. The Rhode Island Poet Laureate from 1994 to 99, she talks about that in this 2009 New Letters on the Air interview when she was a UMKC Cockafair Chair Writer-in-Residence. But first, she reads from her nonfiction book, published after she was awarded the 2004 MacArthur Genius Fellowship, Cooling Time, An American Vigil. Here's C.D. Wright.
It is all too fair to assume most of us are poets, or we wouldn't be reading this, not when we could be watching the Redskins, or be down in the den cleaning the guns, or communicating something tangibly effective that we could either sell or otherwise have the opportunity to make available to crowds such as porn stars and evangelists routinely reach. I think poetry must, I think it must, stay open all night in beautiful cellars, Merton insisted, and so do I, and why doesn't it, and where and when, and how does our awareness of its shrunken territory, that of the specialized cult, abjure further separation and negation and seek to reverse directions? What is troublesome about poets sequestered at the university is that unless we go to trade school or are exempt as trust fund cases, in the sight of potential employers, we might as well bear the mark of the beast. As a result, the university is virtually the only place for us. In the nation at large, being a poet is suspect at best. Read? I don't read. Reading's for queers, said one respondent to a recent poll on literacy. What a country. I am among many of the hard-pressed to accept the fixed-foot, flat-earth survivalist school of poetry, calling itself new formalism as being new, much less formally interesting. By the same reading, only by lack of scrutiny and challenge could free verse poets call verse free. It had been my own aspiration when I first undertook to write poetry, to read and make poetry, that it would bring people together. My aspirations are still pitched high, though my expectations of it being either a source or beneficiary of this virtuous byproduct have subsided. At times, I am half persuaded the reasons for exhaustively articulated divisions among contemporary American poets are real. At other times, I think they are fundamentally French. For the most part, I suspect the skirmishes are pertinent to clarification, and yet more relational to our removal from the public sphere, the near total disenfranchisement of the American intellectual, eventually leading to the proverbial infighting that throttles any worthwhile effort. Pure poetry, nonstop, it is wearing. I get so tired of the sect of poetry. I want my writing to be exploratory and animate and profound. I want to touch my blameless dreams, even if to date it is all paper and mistakes. Can anyone get there writing unadulterated poetry? Now that I am beyond the initial paralysis of calling one's first teachings into question, I am left with, be critical and sing. The great barrier of objectivity, it is the banal standard of professionalism. Poetry is the language of intensity. Because we are going to die, an expression of intensity is justified.
That's from the middle of the book by C.D. Wright called Cooling Time, An American Poetry Vigil. This is New Letters on the Air. It's interesting because you're at the end of a week here at the University of Missouri, Kansas City for the Cockafair Chair, and you've been spending all this academic time as a poet, which you do in your day-to-day life because you teach at Brown. But at the same time, you were also the poet laureate of Rhode Island for about 5 years, mm-hmm. and trying to be a poet for the people. Did you feel that at all, being poet laureate, or was the position more honorary, or did you do any outreach?
That was not a very demanding role. I did a few things on request, but the most considered thing that I did was a reader's map of Rhode Island, and I had previously done a reader's map of Arkansas that began with the DeSoto Chronicles. And it created a kind of description of the state in literature. I found many, many wonderful lyricists in Arkansas, you know, as we moved into the 20th century. And in Rhode Island, it began with religious tracts. So I really liked doing that. I liked creating a description of the state before the state was a state and then moving it forward in time and respecting people writing from a lot of different genres. It was really a bibliography. It had the author's name and dates, the part of the township that they were most closely identified with, either by birth or residence, and their genre and three of their most visible titles.
That's a neat thing. And did you discover any writers that you didn't know about before, poets in particular?
Well, of course I did in Rhode Island because it wasn't my native state, and I had one incredible discovery in the Arkansas bibliography, and it involved a lot of other kinds of commissions and pieces, so I ended up traveling the state. I kept hearing about a woman named Bess Miller Brigham who lived in Horatio, which is, you know, not much of a town, near Hope, where President Clinton came from. And I finally found that she had published a book with Knopf called Heaved from the Earth, and I then started discovering that she had published an enormous amount of writing in very, very public magazines like Harper's Bazaar and
really?
The Nation. And she published very, very widely in Canada and the U.S. and to some extent in Mexico in about a 5-year period in the early 70s. But she lived really out in the sticks. When I drove to Horatio with a videographer and a folklorist and a photographer to interview her in her little house, there was a cabinet that her husband had made for her that was full of manuscripts that were in big black binders, and the titles were written on the sides of them in nail polish, like To Live as a Bird. They were lovely books and titles, and I knew that this was like the real deal.
To discover this body of work and this person from your own home state, I mean, that had to be quite exciting.
Oh, that was really fun. That was fun. So that's always there to be tapped into. I'm a very big believer in the genius of the local.
You went there with a videographer, a folklorist, and a photographer. Mm-hmm. Was the photographer your friend?
Deborah Lester, with whom I do a lot of big projects, right? That was the first big project we did together. It was a Lost Roads project, a walk-in book of Arkansas.
And then your most recent publication with her was One Big Self, where you guys visited several prisons that are all right there together in Louisiana.
That was a big project.
That was a huge project because she did all these portraits.
She did about 1,500 portraits. I mean, it was a very labor-intensive project on her part.
It would seem like it would be on your part, too, because you were doing portraits, too. I mean, but just in words and poems. You had to get to know these people, didn't you?
Well, you know, I just had to do a kind of immersion in what the world of incarceration is like. So I did a lot of reading. I did a lot of film watching. I listened to a lot of recordings. I visited with inmates. I did some correspondence with inmates. I interviewed different kinds of officials in the criminal justice system. My method of research I made up, but it did involve a fair amount of it.
I thought I would have you read one of the short pieces, Black is the Color. It gives some insight just into the world there.
Black is the color of that big, old, ugly hole of 77% of the inmates in Angola, of your true love's hair, of 66% of the inmates at St. Gabriel, of the executioner's corduroy hood, hung on an ice hook in the tool shed away from the kids.
That's from the book by C.D. Wright, One Big Self, An Investigation. Well, your newest book out from Copper Canyon Press is called Rising, Falling, Hovering. Talk about the book a bit.
Its themes, I suppose, are my own family and my long-term engagement with Mexico and the Iraq War. So I don't know, I wanted to write a beautiful book and I wanted to write a ferocious book. I wanted to put those two things together. There's not a lot of humor in it, but I think there is some beauty in it, and I know there's some anger in it.
You do like to look at the truth to see what's really there. There's a fierceness sometimes to your work, I think.
I feel like that's my charge as a poet, is to see things as clearly as I possibly can, to see them better than I could see them if I weren't having to articulate what I think I'm seeing, and if I weren't trying to do it in a way that puts a fair amount of pressure on the language.
Rising, falling, hovering is a bit tough to excerpt, so why don't I let you pick?
Re-happiness in pursuit thereof. It is 2005, just before landfall. Here I am, a labyrinth, and I am a mess. I'm located at the corner of Waterway and Bluff. I need your help. You will find me to the left of the graveyard, where the trees grow especially talkative at night, where fog and alcohol rub off the edge. We burn to make one another sing, to stay the lake that it not boil earth, not rock. We are running on Aztec time, fifth and final cycle. Eyes switch on, off. We would be mercurochrome to one another, bee balm or chamomile. We should be concrete, glass, and spandex. We should be digital, or at least early. Be ivory-billed, invisible except to the most prepared observer. We will be stardust, ancient tailings of nothing. Elapsed breath. No, we must first be ice, be nails, be teeth, be lightning.
The late C.D. Wright in 2009, reading from her Griffin Poetry Award-winning book, Rising, Falling, Hovering, from Copper Canyon Press, the publisher of several of her books, including a companion essay collection to Cooling Time, with a list of a title that begins The Poet, The Lion, Talking Pictures. It was released near the time of her unexpected death in her sleep at home in Rhode Island on January 12, 2016, less than a week after her 67th birthday. She left behind her poet husband and son, Forrest and Brecht Gander. April 2016 marks the publication of her last poetry book, Shall Cross. For links to her work and our two interviews with C.D. Wright, go to newletters.org. A production of New Letters Magazine at UMKC, this past American Voice was produced with Jamie Walsh, Cassie Vaughn, and Danny Moran. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.